and he said, hey, come here right now. I got an opportunity that could be a fit for you. And fast forward, a week later, I had a job.
Hello and welcome back to the Arena Podcast by Kauffman Fellows, where we dive deep into the stories of some of the most fabled names in VC. I'm your producer, Nihar Nilakanti, and this podcast is hosted by Jeff Harbach, CEO of Kauffman Fellows. Joining us in today's episode is Jonathan Lehr, co-founder and general partner at Workbench, where he invests in early-stage enterprise software. Jonathan is also a Kauffman Fellow from Class 19. We can't wait to share his story with you, so let's get right to it.
All right, welcome back to the Arena Podcast by Kauffman Fellows. We are here today with John Lehr. John, you are in the arena. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. It's a pleasure to have you. John, I'm going to read your bio first so people get to know you. John is a general partner at Workbench, where he invests in early stage enterprise startups out of New York. Previously, John was at Morgan Stanley, where his team served as conduits for new technology at the firm. In 2012, he founded the New York Enterprise Technology Meetup. Since then, the group has now grown to over 5,000 members. He studied bioengineering, mathematics, and economics at the University of Pennsylvania. And John is a Kauffman Fellow from Class 19. That's incredible. Tell me about, I got to hear about this New York Enterprise Technology Meetup that's grown to over 5,000 members.
Great. And again, thanks so much for having me. The meetup spun out of an experience I was having at Morgan Stanley, where I was in this very unique role called the Office of the CIO. And what we did was basically help evaluate emerging technology startups on behalf of the firm from a vendor perspective. A lot of people outside of financial services don't appreciate this, but banks are actually the earliest and largest adopters of enterprise software. So at Morgan Stanley, for instance, we had a $4 billion IT budget. So my team in this Office of the CIO group was actually tasked with meeting hundreds of startups a year and all of the brand name Silicon Valley VC funds that you would recognize, all with the aim of figuring out which startups should we do business with to either generate new revenue opportunities, cut costs, or just generate new efficiencies internally. And it was really through that role that I learned, first of all, the domain expertise of enterprise software, because it's not something that you just come out of school with the firsthand experience in. But more importantly, I learned about really the fundamental change going on in all the technology that was powering Fortune 500 companies. So there was this old adage, you don't get fired for buying IBM. I saw firsthand, not only could you get fired for buying IBM, but you need to understand the 50 or 100 different startups that are disintermediating all of their different solutions. So fast forward to starting the meetup, the way that this got going is I was at Morgan Stanley in New York, looking around New York's ecosystem in 2011. And at the time, New York was really known as an ad tech town, a consumer tech town, media town. And we had a lot of huge hits in the startup world from this space. And I looked around and there were tons of meetups going on. Most prominent was the New York Tech Meetup that would meet down by NYU every single month and get 800 people to come every single month to see tech demos. It was incredible. It really brought New York's tech community together. And it was something that I was just very impressed by. Now, the thing that happened there, though, is for enterprise startups, which are really focused on solving 4,500 pain points and really predicated on having business models, one of the big no-nos of the New York Tech Meetup was that you weren't allowed to ask, how do you monetize? There was always one month a newbie in the room. They would raise their hand and ask that question to a two-minute demoer, and they would honestly get booed. And it was super intense. So meanwhile, I'm looking around and I'm like, they've built a genuine community and brought together startups and VCs and all these different subject matter experts together around consumer tech. Why on earth in New York, where we have 52 of the Fortune 500 headquartered here and a thriving tech community at large, why don't we have a meetup focused on enterprise software? And the real goal in starting this was to bring together what we here at Workbench affectionately call the suits and the hoodies of the world, AKA the corporate buyers and the startups. Because day in, day out, whether you were my level at Morgan Stanley all the way up to the CIO, you were getting inundated with calls. And it was a very transactional pitch. Hey, I'm a Silicon Valley startup. I want to sell you this for storage or virtualization. But meanwhile, why weren't people taking the fun of the pizza and beer and meetup atmosphere and that authentic connection, the authentic connections that were going on there, and basically just applying that to the enterprise. So what I did is I decided in January 2012 to actually, I had to file a formal outside business interest to Morgan Stanley to do this meetup in my free time. I got Cooley to sponsor it and host the event, and it was off to the races. And it's been an incredible journey that 7.5 years in, we still organize every single month.
How many people showed up to your first meetup?
So we're actually really proud. The first meetup had 150 people.
And so from 100,
and it was all quality too.
And from 150 to 5,000.
Yep.
Incredible.
It's been a fun journey growing it. And we're probably at like even 6,500 now. I've already lost track.
Incredible. Incredible. And this clearly led to what you're doing now at Workbench. Tell us a little bit about Workbench.
So Workbench is an enterprise VC fund. We're based in New York City. And what we're trying to do is rethink enterprise VC doing two things. Number one is leveraging our past lives in corporate IT. And number two is by using all of the concentration of Fortune 500 companies in New York City to flip the existing model on its head. And what I mean by that is instead of starting with the whiz bang tech, now I'm going to grossly overgeneralize, but a day in the life at Morgan Stanley was, hey, I left Google. Hey, I invented this database tech at Facebook. Let me go now start a company and sell it to you as a vendor at Morgan Stanley. Far too often, unfortunately, at that Morgan role, it was a square peg in a round hole because none of the startups, not none, few of the startups had customer empathy. And it was almost a dirty word to say something like, hey, what's the rip and replace cost? Or what's the actual use case for your software internally beyond the whiz bang tech? So what we're doing at Workbench is instead of starting with that whiz bang tech, we have all these different corporate IT executives in New York City across FinServ, pharma, media, et cetera. What we do is very simple and almost practical. We start with them to understand what are your most pressing pain points that are top three initiatives you have to solve for this year that you have budget allocated to solve. We use that as our starting point to be thesis driven. We then will post content that we research extensively. We'll host meetups. We'll speak to VCs in our network, all with the goal of figuring out who are the best companies that solve these problems. And then we simply play matchmaker, where the corporate is getting a tailored solution to their problem, almost in a consultative way. The startup is getting oxygen, aka intros to the right people at the right time for extremely meaningful contracts earlier in their life. And for us, I mean, we're not doing it just to be good guys. We also are de-risking investments while we go and earning allocations in very competitive financing rounds. So it helps the entrepreneurs, it helps corporates, and it helps us. So it's been a really fun model so far.
Workbench has had an incredible impact on the New York ecosystem and at entrepreneurs at large across the U.S. and around the world. So you've been doing some really great work, and I'm proud of the work that you've done. John, we met, back 5+ years ago, and you had started, I think, just started Workbench. Yep. I mean, you were probably a year or two in. And I remember first meeting you. I remember feeling that I had met somebody that was very grounded, very faith-based, very family focused, and certainly a leader in New York tech. What I would love to go into is when we look at the totality of what you've built over the last 7.5 years with the New York Enterprise Technology Meetup, with Workbench, people that would look at that would go, this person is clearly very successful, very put together individual. And that's exactly what I got from you the first time that I met you, and that's been validated ever since. But that doesn't come right away. That's something that is built over time, and it's built through lots of different formative experiences, and you've had many of them. So I'd love to talk about those and kind of take the listener and me through this journey arc of your life and your career. So let's zoom backwards to when you first, kind of the early formative years, your parents. Tell us about your parents. Tell us about where they're from, and give us a little background story of your early years growing up.
Definitely, I'd love to. And first of all, thanks so much for those kind words. Hopefully I can live up to them. My mom is actually born and raised in Brussels, Belgium. And her parents were in the Holocaust. And she actually moved to Miami, where I was born, when she was 13 years old. So she moved. She did not speak any English. And she went straight into junior high school, and kind of was an outsider. She had to learn the language when everyone else was speaking English and just adapt pretty quickly. You also fast forward now to my dad, who grew up in Brooklyn, and he moved to Miami after a frozen semester at the University of Rochester, where he goes, I got to get out of here. So he thought of the hottest place he could go to, and he went to University of Miami. And his mother passed away when he was 20, and his dad wasn't very involved in his life. So he had to figure out a lot of stuff on his own. So you have my mom, who grew up as an immigrant, coming into this country and tried to really just build a network and make friends and adapt to the different culture. As you can imagine, Miami versus Belgium, very different. And it's interesting because one of the things that she's taught me consistently over time is the value of networks and just knowing people. And I think that really is where I got the earliest sense of community, because that could be a network religiously. So I'm a practicing Jew, and every Friday I have Sabbath dinner with my family. We go to synagogue on Saturdays. And when my mom was growing up, having the Jewish day school and the synagogue community was a way to already start meeting people. My mom also was a mediator for many years. And when I was 12 years old, ran to be a county court judge against an incumbent. And when I helped her as a little 12-year-old with my brother, who's 18 months younger, campaign around Miami to all the different groups, I saw firsthand again. She had to work with different communities. She had to build up her network in order to get support. It's not even one of those things where it was an empty slot and multiple people were running. It was even harder for her because she was going against a known incumbent. But that grit and that hard work and the way that she was able to listen to people, understand their needs, and then just basically speak to them in a meaningful way helped her win. And meanwhile, I'm 34 now, so she's been a judge for over 20 years and had numerous re-elections that she's continued to win.
Amazing.
Thank you. And when you flash back to my dad now, he went to University of Miami Law School, which is where my mom and dad met. And his mantra, which has always guided me, is you do what you got to do. And look, his mother unfortunately passed away when he was 20. He didn't know what he was going to do career-wise. He actually thought he would be pre-med. And he ended up not really being able to focus on school and read a lot. So he realized what he was really good at was law. Ironically, not for the reading, but actually by changing the rules and actually listening to arguments in ways that people don't. So as a funny aside, my dad's a criminal defense attorney. The people that are his favorite to go against in criminal cases are actually Harvard-trained lawyers. So not to bash Harvard Law, but what he jokes about is that they're so by the book that he's able to just basically play them and win the case by understanding dynamics that they're just not sometimes creative enough to think about. So that obviously that's not like a blanket statement, but it has kind of molded my upbringing, where he'll look at scenarios from different perspectives beyond just quote unquote the book, and thought of creative ways to just produce good outcomes. And he's had his own law firm ever since he was younger. So those were my two role models growing up that I've continued to just learn from every day.
Two incredible role models. Tell me, you know, your dad's mantra of you do what you got to do. How has that impacted you? Has that become your mantra? Have you kind of built your own for yourself? What role does that play?
So I live by both my mom and my dad's words. And when you focus on you do what you got to do, I think it's always important to learn by actions, not just by saying. And the way my dad exemplified this at work is every Shabbat, the Sabbath, we would be together. But if this was a Saturday night after the Sabbath ended and he had to meet a client, he was running out there. If this was a Sunday morning and he had to go somewhere, he would go there. We grew up in Miami and in the Aventura area, but if he had to go to South Dade and then Palm Beach, which is all the way north, and back down to Broward, my dad could be driving hours a day for different cases and whatnot. He never complained. He just did the work. And when I think about myself, and whether it was starting the meetup in my free time outside of Morgan Stanley or starting Workbench, which has been its own incredible journey, but not without the hard work. I mean, there's just so many ways in which it's a late night or an early morning, or you got to get on a plane for an important meeting and you're just zonked out and you've pushed for weeks straight and you might need a break. Of course, there's the perspective, which I could get into, on how family grounds you for all this, but having that work ethic, which candidly, I think does separate a lot of people today in terms of their success in the workplace, because sometimes it is lacking. It's a guiding mantra for me.
Let's get into that a little bit, because, you know, clearly your parents are very focused. Grit would describe them. Hard work would describe them. They've achieved so much, yet they also were very community focused, very faith-based. You practiced Shabbats. You went to synagogue. How do you now find this balance in your life? Clearly it looks like they were individuals that stressed balance. How do you now manage that balance with, I know you are a very big family man. You have a beautiful family. Tell us how you balance the driving hard work and grit that you clearly got from your parents with also this balance of community and family and everything else. How do you do that?
So I think it's one of the hardest things in startup world today. And I actually saw a tweet about it this weekend about how do people think about work-life balance. And I think it comes down to, in today's workplace with remote teams and this always on between Slack and emails and whatnot, I think you have to be very, what's the right word here? Intentional is the word I'm thinking of. You have to be very intentional about it. And what I mean by that is there's always another email to answer. And look, Jeff, as I learned in Kaufman, there's always another founder to meet. There's always another VC to meet. There's always something that you can do. But you also have to just be thoughtful about the journey and yourself. And specifically, what the way I approach it is I have a base that is, first of all, my family. That is most important. So my wife, my two children, and then my extended family, my parents, my brother. Without that as a grounding force, I don't think that you can really push and have that grit for the long haul. Everyone, no matter how successful you are, how much people read about startups that are up and to the right and whatnot, there's always going to be bumps. And I think it's having that support system internally that helps you get through them. And specifically for me, especially in the early days of Workbench, today actually marks the 6-year anniversary, coincidentally, of starting Workbench with my co-founder, Jess. And I've actually been doing a lot of reflection this past weekend because of this milestone. And there, in the early days, it was always, always, always on Saturday nights, Sundays. And the key for me was that because I had the Sabbath, that Friday night to Saturday night, no matter what, even if there's a hot deal I was chasing, which has happened before, I would tell the founder or my team, I have to shut off. And that in of itself is a nice forcing function for family time. And then on top of that, I'm very lucky that I can control my hours for the most part. So the way that my second step is making sure that I have one-on-one time with my wife, Michaela, where we can do a date night. Or if I want to see my kid who's now in preschool, see a little show that he's putting on, I prioritize that. But the balancing force is that you also then have to put in the work the rest of the time. So that could be if I wasn't in the office in the morning, I make sure that night, you bet your butt that I'm putting in hours later. And look, at the end of the day, it means that there's a lot of hours that are being consumed for you. But when I value my family and what I'm able to build at Workbench so much, I'm able to be more thoughtful about it. And I don't know if this is going to be relevant for a lot of people, but for me, it helps me stay grounded and actually not burn out. Because even though I'm putting in, sometimes I'll be up at 1 a.m. doing those emails or working on a pitch deck or something to help a founder, I earlier in that morning may have been with my kids, or I might have come home early to have dinner with the family and then log back in. And that balance, which again is a very fortunate situation to have, just gives me tons of stamina to hopefully keep Workbench going for the long haul.
I love that. I hope our listeners are getting a lot from this, because you're right. You are now in a fortunate position, but you weren't always, yet balance has always been a part of your life. And so you've always focused on the balance. And I think that's something that's just critical for especially young entrepreneurs, young venture capitalists, young professionals to think about this balance, of work and life. So I love that you said that. One of my favorite questions that we ask on the show is talking about what would you, if you had the opportunity to look a younger version of yourself in the face and either give that version of yourself some advice or tell them thank you for doing the work that you did or just talk to them, what would you say? We usually save that for the end of the show, but we're going to try something different here. I'd love to, looking back at this kind of this first chapter of your life, the early years, let's pick an age. Maybe we'll say the 10-year-old John. What would you say to the 10-year-old John if you were able to go back and talk to them today?
So there's a word in Judaism called besheret, which means it's meant to be. And what I would say is that your college and early career life is going to be bumpy and seemingly random and kind of crazy at times. but it's all Bashar. It's meant to be, and it's going to get you to your dream job, which, again, I'm super grateful to be in right now. So I think that's the one word, that it's Bashar. And for any basketball fans, it's like Joel Embiid, trust the process.
Evoking Joel Embiid in the podcast. I love it. All right, let's go into post-high school. Tell us about what were some of the formative experiences that happened to you, both kind of high school, university time frame as an early adult.
Yeah, so in high school, so my whole family was in law. I didn't know any. Miami is known as law and real estate or being a doctor. And I didn't want to do one of those three things. So I didn't even know what Wall Street was growing up. I thought it meant everyone was a stockbroker. There was basically no tech, let alone enterprise tech, down in Miami. So I was in an older kid's math class my junior year of high school. And a lot, when I was a senior, a lot of those friends were now freshmen in college. So I turned to a buddy. And I'm the oldest in my family, so I didn't have like an older cousin or anything to turn to. And I said, what should I major in? And he said, you know what? You should do biomedical engineering. It's hard as hell. You're going to do a lot of different courses, but you're going to like it. And sure enough, I didn't have any other things I was thinking of. So signed up to be a bioengineer. Meanwhile, fast forward to freshman, sophomore year of school. While most of the students were taking maybe four courses a semester, I was taking five or six. And labs on top. And the other fun part is my high school had strong suits in some areas like math, but I was competing against kids that had AP bio, AP chem, and those weren't even offered in my school. So to keep it real, I got my ass kicked. I went from being basically a straight A student in high school, didn't really have to put in much work. I had a lot of fun. I was captain of the basketball team, president of computer club, went out all the time. With a balance and whatnot, but I didn't have to do too much in terms of schoolwork. And you mentioned Grip before. That was a book I love from Angela Duckworth, because I will say that while my friends were in college doing those four courses and going for happy hours and partying more, I definitely had to catch up in terms of some of the coursework I was in just to keep up, and not even excel, just to keep up and stay afloat. And as a young guy, getting that kick in the butt, I think, was very healthy. Because too many people today, are overly coddled, and you hit that speed bump and it doesn't go your way, and maybe you give up or you whine or complain. Obviously, I was frustrated, but I learned that you got to just put in that time to keep up, and welcome to real life kind of thing.
So, John, you spent all this time, 4 or 5 years, however long it took you at school, doing a biomedical engineering degree. And then you come out and you're thinking, gosh, I really want to go into VC. Some people would look at that and go, I busted my tail for those years in college, doing all this work, not going out with my friends, staying and doing labs, putting all this time into a degree that now you're no longer going to pursue. I can imagine some people feeling really having a heavy heart about that, or going, gosh, I just wasted that time of my life. How did you view that? What were your thoughts coming out of spending all that time doing my biomedical engineering and not pursuing something like that for your career?
So the way I approached bioengineering was, I thought that potentially out of school, I would get a job doing something biotech related. And I actually had very formative internships at Johnson & Johnson for a stent company. So right in the medical device field. And I basically got the dream internship that a biomedical engineer could want, right? I was home. First of all, I got to go home to Miami to this company, Cordis, which was a J&J subsidiary. And I was with a Princeton biomedical engineer, a Duke bioengineer, and we're in new product development. It didn't get more exciting than that. Fast forward to what we actually did all day. We were editing test protocols day in, day out, making red lines here and there, and then helping with cleaning up some of the lab stuff and the equipment. And I get why we had to do that, because it's so FDA regulated that why would you have a bunch of college kids doing something that would actually affect the product? But meanwhile, the thing I learned that summer is that, candidly, the pace of growth career-wise was not what I was looking for at that place. I had a friend from high school who was 6 years older doing the job of someone who was 15 years older for her, and she wasn't able to get the promotion, even though she'd been doing her boss's job, who had left for over a year. So I actually viewed the opportunity and that learning with a lot of gratitude, because to define by negation that early in my, even before my career, through an internship, like, hey, this is not what I want, helped save me graduating, working there, and then kind of being lost, so to speak, in terms of what I wanted. So that actually coincided with my first internship was sophomore year. So it coincided with taking an engineering entrepreneurship class. at Penn. And that really opened my eyes to what actually venture is. The whole class, it was my most formative class in college, and it operated through case studies of Hewlett Packard back in the day and Sun, and really taught about entrepreneurship and startups and the math behind VC. And from that point forward, I was doubling down, like, I need to do anything I can to get into VC. And still at that point, I had no idea what enterprise software was. And it's kind of funny how I got here today, but I was looking into potentially biotech venture capital. So I actually don't think it was so much as like a waste opportunity as much as, hey, I worked my butt off. I've demonstrated that I can take this rigorous course load. And without sounding cliche, I also showed I could learn how to learn, because you would do this advanced math and then apply it in something like fluid dynamics, which I'm not going to pretend I could even remember any of that today, but it was all about learning and then applying it to new situations, which intellectually was very just interesting. And it definitely was a lot of fun.
What was your first job coming out of school once you graduated?
Yeah. So my first job was actually at a hedge fund, and it lasted for 3 months. And the story here is it's actually the craziest start to career that I've heard from my friend group. I graduated in 07, and we could get into the struggle of competing against Wharton kids who have done this full time to get a job at a hedge fund. I actually had to do interviews almost every single day of senior year, and I didn't get a job until 3 days before graduation. Because
they're sitting there going, how do we evaluate you? Like, what do we do with you?
Exactly. And that's been a recurring theme throughout my career, whether it was there. And the answer is I was able to do math in my head really well, and they took a shot on me. As an aside, when I was looking to get into VC, everyone looked and they're like, who the hell is this corporate IT guy? We know investment bankers and we know founders and product people from startups. We don't know this IT thing. So that is it has been an interesting thread. But my first start of my career, I worked so hard to get this job. 3 months out, it's Labor Day of 2007. You have the world about to collapse with the financial crisis. And my boss of a 10-man hedge fund ends up dead in a pool. Now, there was a crazy sensationalist story, because apparently he was on drugs. His brother accused his wife of murder. I was about to fly home for Rosh Hashanah to see my family and have my grandma ask me how work is. And in an instant, the whole fund was basically done for. And after spending a year trying to get a job as a bioengineer with no experience, I had to now look around and say, hey, the economy's about to crumble and I need to find a job, because I have an apartment in New York now and I have to pay for that. So it was a pretty rough time, September 2007.
Yeah. How did you deal with that? I can't even imagine having a boss unexpectedly drown in a pool.
Yeah.
How did you kind of make sense of that? You went home clearly for Memorial Day. Walk us through your thought process.
Yeah. Then. So my natural personality, and maybe this is just because of my upbringing, is you can kind of feel it and have the emotions and think through it. But immediately in situations like that, you have to focus on execution. So, okay, this happened. Let's evaluate. What's the scenario? Is there any chance the company is going to stay open? Do I immediately tap my network? Are there people that I know now from a few months of working that may know of other opportunities for me? And really, it was a race against the clock, because again, other people, like I think it was right either before or right after Bear Stearns had went under, and you could tell that a lot of people were about to lose a lot of jobs. And look, I was very fortunate once again with the whole Tuna Bisharit, which has guided my career a lot. I was kind of a little bit jealous of some friends because they did the whole, hey, I'm going to graduate and travel for a couple months after college. I did not go abroad as a bioengineer. And then I went straight into the workforce a week after graduation. That was the best thing in my life, because one of the managers who had coincidentally left a few weeks prior, and he had been a bit of a mentor to me there, I called him up as soon as the news hit. And he said, hey, come here right now. I got an opportunity that could be a fit for you. And fast forward, a week later, I had a job. And it was all because I'd had this relationship with this guy. I managed to overlap with him before he had left. And it's one of those things where, look, you asked me May 2007. I'm like, oh, I wish I could have a couple months off and relax a little bit. But that was the best thing for my career, had I not been able to land that immediate job thereafter.
John, I'd love to go into some of your career transitions and ask you about, you know, give us maybe one or two examples of places where you've gone from, you know, you've had so many of them, going from biomedical engineering to hedge fund to Morgan Stanley to now Workbench. Can you paint a picture for us in maybe one or two of these inflection points that happened in your life where walk us through kind of what happened there and more importantly, what you learned from them as someone that's gone through multiple different iterations in a career?
So in that role, as I started explaining earlier, I was exposed to something pretty unique in the sense that I was understanding from the other side of the table how startups get evaluated and onboarded at a leading Fortune 500 company. And I saw where billions of dollars of budget go and the opportunity here and now for enterprise startups. And I had all this knowledge, all this information at my fingertips, and I saw candidly where the opportunity was, where, in my opinion, some VCs were either stuck in their old models or honestly not even caring about changing because what they were doing was successful for them. So the transition to go into Workbench was actually very lucky, like a lot of other things in my career, where I actually was first interviewing for jobs at existing funds. And if you look at the New York landscape back in 2012, there weren't a lot of enterprise funds. So I knew that I wanted to do enterprise software, and I knew that I wanted to do it in New York because of, at the time, now my wife, but at the time, fiance, as well as just a sense that the community was ripe for something different. And I spent every day for a year, whether using the meetup and just all the relationships I was building at Morgan to figure out a way to break into venture. And it sounds kind of standard, like, oh, it takes a while to break into VC. But through the meetup, I had built a very differentiated network. I was getting top companies from Silicon Valley to fly over to meet and present to our community. I was able to bring some of those to meet some New York VCs. I was able to use some of my relationships from Morgan Stanley and other banks to help startups from other existing VCs' portfolio. So every single day for a year, I was dead set at that point where I knew I wanted venture. And because of this formative experience at Morgan Stanley, I knew I wanted enterprise VC. And I got so many no's between, again, as I mentioned earlier, you're an IT guy. What on earth do you know about venture? To, hey, you don't have the right background and we want a startup person. Or, hey, enterprise software, that's not going to work in New York. You should move to the Valley. And it's a mix of, once again, that grit and just that determination paired with, candidly, a lot of luck. Because the way that I ended up getting the opportunity for Workbench was all of this meetup activity I was doing in my nights and weekends, and it had already grown the group to 1,500 members. I was actually reached out to by the CEO of our Donnelly, Tom Quinlan, because he was actually our first anchor LP in Workbench. And he also funded our community to get it going in the early days. And had I not been out there banging the drum for enterprise in New York, and just every night, day in, day out, no matter how tired I was, meeting a VC for coffee, meeting a new startup for a drink, to pitch to a VC, to try to build that relationship. Had I not done that, I wouldn't have built a name for being that crazy New York enterprise guy back in 2013. But because I had done that, and again, a nice dose of luck, when R. Donnelly was looking to do something with enterprise software in New York, several different people sent the CEO my way. And the rest is very fortunately history.
One of the things I love learning about in people's journeys is what gets them out of bed in the morning. You know, we study this from some of the, you know, historical figures that have come across the landscape to Coffin Fellows, to people that we read about. And there's always this recurring theme of, if you're trying to do something new or if you're trying to do something hard, you're going to get way more no's before you get yeses, right? You said, yeah. Many people were looking at you like you had, you know, three sets of eyes because you were trying to do something that had not been done before in New York City. My question for you is, what is, after getting your shins kicked in every single day, lots of no's, you go home, you spend the time with your fiance, your wife, your family, and then you go to bed, you wake up the next morning. What are you telling yourself that very next morning where you say, all right, I'm about to go to battle again. I know I'm about to get my shins kicked again all day long today, but this might be the day that someone says yes. This might be the day that I plant a seed that actually makes this happen. What were some of the things that you did for yourself to get you in that kind of mindset every single time when you're trying to make this happen?
So it's two key things. Number one, it's calling my dad and having and talking about that rough day and him saying, John, you know what I'm about to say. You do what you got to do. If you know this to be certain that there's an opportunity here and this is your dream, you can't give up. The other person that was critical here was my wife, Michaela. I mean, I'm so fortunate to have a partner who takes the time to actually talk and understand on a very deep level, not just what I do, but what drives me. And look, for anyone who's tried and failed at something repeatedly over and over, you know that it actually is really hard to just wake up that next day. So to be totally honest, it wasn't like I woke up rosy every single day. There were some of those rejections where, to give you an example, I got married in 2013. I did my bachelor party a few months before that. And I did my Thursday night of my bachelor party, a VC interview call. Right. While I was away, stepped back. Actually, no, it wasn't Thursday night. It was Friday morning. So I had to be tame Thursday, basically, without getting into details. I was that focused on breaking in that Friday morning. I made sure I was in a good state to be bringing my best to an interview. And again, fast forward, they ended up wanting someone that time with previous venture experience. But looking back, I'm so grateful I didn't get that role because I wouldn't have gotten to do everything I'm doing with Workbench. But between my dad's that mantra, between Michaela being able to talk every single day, between Michaela being patient, between her giving me new ideas, or just basically being that shoulder to vent on, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. It literally took 1 year straight of almost every single day doing something, making some intro, working my ass off. And the other interesting thing is you also learn a lot about people in that situation, because a lot of people will use you, especially being in Morgan Stanley at the time in that role, with the introductions I could make and the meetup, the value I could add through that community. And you remember that because you see a lot about people where there were some people that helped me that I will forever be indebted to. And there's some that I make sure to avoid now because I know their true colors. So it's a long process, but you learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about the people that you interface with, and hopefully you can stay focused long enough and have a strategy of differentiation to actually make it a reality with that right bit of luck thrown in.
John, you're clearly someone that has values that drive you, some core values, some a set of moral philosophies. What are some of the things, you know, maybe just a couple that you would point to that really drive you and ground you in what you're doing today?
So the first thing that I share with my entire team is we're all oddly obsessed with enterprise software. We just love it. And it just makes coming to work so much fun. But on a bit more of a serious note, one of the things that's very interesting intellectually about this is that you're trying to change behaviors. And if you think about Fortune 500 companies and you think about the actual people who work there, they have day jobs, the proverbial 9 to 5, 9 to 6. And when you're introducing something like a startup and a workflow change and a behavior change, it's extremely difficult to do. So there's a bit of a psychology element. But when you do pull things off, the scale of that impact is immensely rewarding. So that's one driver from an intellectual perspective. The other thing is that me and my co-founder, Jess, we always root for the underdogs. And the opportunity to rethink VC with this corporate-first approach when everyone else thinks it's crazy and hire a team with similar backgrounds, it's really enabled us to have an amazing cohesive unit and such a fun collaborative environment as a team. And Jeff, I don't have to tell you, you see firsthand how many venture funds are having issues these days on a slew of issues related to culture and their behavior. And for us, we use this as a strength because unlike a lot of VCs that may sometimes act in mercenary ways, all of us have different swim lanes of focus from a sector perspective, but we come together as a unit and help each other through our networks, through diligencing stuff together, through helping each other's portfolio companies. And the amount of laughs that we have in person and on Slack on a daily basis is just nuts. So you have a fun environment, you have the underdog mentality, we're changing behaviors at the Fortune 500. And the last thing that drives us is a focus on diversity, and especially the Women in Enterprise software initiatives that my co-founder Jess leads. So everything from monthly lunches to meetups that we host, that's a lot of that stuff, a database of enterprise startups founded by women. When we looked around, Jess has a crazy stat that women in tech that get funded is pretty low. But if you think about women in enterprise tech, that number is even minuscule compared to it. And you think about how few female executives there are at large Fortune 500 companies, we wanted to make that a way to make an impact as a starting point and use that to then launch other diversity initiatives. And between the community first approach that we have and some of the conferences we've done, like the Navigate Summit that Jess did with 300 leading female executives of enterprise startups and Fortune 100 corporations, it just feels good to make that impact. And we have our swim lane of enterprise software, and we want to just make an impact in that industry.
Amen, brother. Tell us about the where Coffin Fellows fits in your journey.
I am so grateful to have been part of Class 19. And what I love about Kaufman is, even though the two-year program ended for me years ago, you make friends, colleagues, and just continue learning as part of the group. So even opportunities like this to stay in touch with you, Jeff, to be able to have this conversation today, to go to the annual summits, it helped me learn. And again, I was the IT guy that knew nothing, right? It helped expedite my knowledge, not just of tactical stuff, but also to do the right introspection of how am I going to be as a venture investor? Where are my inherent biases that I need to work on? Where can I learn how to diligence companies, both from a quantitative, but also a qualitative perspective in assessing founders? So much of that between my own classmates and then having friends in classes before and after mine is just the best network I could ask for. So I am so grateful that I was able to be a part of the program, and I keep in touch with so many friends from class, and it's been an amazing part of my venture career.
Awesome. John, I love the story here. You clearly learned hard work and grit and balance from your parents and the formative experiences you had there, which led you to, I'm kind of drawing this arc together now of, you know, the gratitude that you experienced and going through a major that helped you learn how to learn. I love that phrase. It's one that I use often with my kids and, you know, my daughters. And how that led you to, you know, through your job search to say, look, you know, when time gets up, I'm going to focus on execution. And ultimately what led you to be able to focus on execution in your values, which clearly you have now come to in Workbench. I love this story arc and the things, the ups and downs that you've gone through. Some of the experiences that you've had are certainly very unique, but also very challenging. And through all of them, you've really kept yourself grounded, kept yourself focused on the things that you're passionate about. And clearly, Bisharit is something that I guess would encapsulate your journey. John, tell me as a wrap up, I just did kind of my mental network of mapping your story, but how would you kind of wrap your story into just a kind of a short segment? And what advice would you give now to the others that are trying to do similar things, break into areas that are right now not popular, or people that think they can't do something? What advice would you give them?
So first of all, find a way to enjoy the journey. I mean, I knew that this was my dream job, and I found a way that even in spite of a lot of the no's I was getting, I had my day job at Morgan Stanley. I had the meetup that kept reinforcing to me that the opportunity is here now for enterprise software. And I just had to find that right person that would take the chance on me. Number two is, I think, find the right support group. I'm so lucky that I have my parents, I have my brother, Michaela, I have my co-founder, Jess, that even in rough days of growing Workbench, there's always somebody to talk to about it. I don't have to bottle it up inside. And it's just been, it's made it so doable for me on this journey. And as I hopefully will continue to scale Workbench with Jess. And I think the last piece is just be honest with yourself. If you have a differentiated strategy, if you have an impact that you can make, what I would say is show, don't tell. So for me, I was very lucky that I was able to use the meetup as a way to demonstrate that there is this opportunity for enterprise in New York. If you're thinking about something in another field, figure out a way that you can demonstrate that and then talk to enough people. And hopefully you get that dose of luck as well. That's going to let somebody take a bet on you. And that's really what it comes down to.
That's incredible advice. Thank you for sharing that. Lightning round, two questions for you, John, before we end.
Yep.
First is, what's the best book that you've read that we should be reading?
So I referenced it before. The most recent book I read was Grit by Angela Duckworth, and it was awesome.
Amazing book. And second, best lunch spot in your neighborhood in New York?
So my favorite spot, that's my go-to, they know my order because it never changes, is Ito Sushi.
Ito Sushi.
97th Street. It is great three-roll special. It's cheap. It's quick for a good business meeting and always good quality food.
There you have it, New Yorkers. John, you are an incredible guest. You're an incredible fellow, an incredible man. Thank you so much for the work you're doing and for being in the arena with us today.
Thank you again so much for this opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning into this week's episode of the Arena Podcast. As always, you can get notified of the latest release by subscribing to our newsletter found in the description of this episode or by visiting fellows.org. That's all for now. We'll catch you in the arena next week.